In 1958, Danny and the Juniors told us rock and roll is here to stay. And by the 1970s, punk had celebrated the triumvirate of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Today's guest says rock and roll played a more substantial role in the history of the last half century. It changed America and spread the values of freedom, equality, human rights, and peace across the globe. He's Sean Kay, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week we try to make sense of the stories and storytellers that shape American public life. This week we're joined by Sean Kay, an accomplished scholar in American foreign policy at Ohio Wesleyan University, who has turned his attention to rock and roll. His new book, Rock in the Free World, charts rock's impact on America and the world. Sean, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So you write in the book that rock and roll, and I'm quoting here, rock and roll is more than a music form. It's an idea, an attitude, a way of thinking about the world. What is that idea?
Yeah, I take a very broad definition here of rock and roll. It's more than the music. It's an ethos almost, an ethic that has served to amplify voices and ideas and causes, while also helping people sort of go introspective, but with common links around the world, literally. I mean, there's been so much of the music. And so in this book, I'm able to trace sort of the origins of that. It starts with I interviewed Jan Wenner, the publisher of Rolling Stone, and when he was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he made the comment that Bob Dylan, I'm paraphrasing, but Bob Dylan gave voice to my America. And so I was really curious what that meant, right? Like, what did that mean that Bob, so there's this spark of a reinforcement of American values that really culminates actually in Bob Dylan, leading up to it with other troubadours, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, et cetera. What happens is you see it manifest in a number of issue areas, specifically revolutionary change, like in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, South Africa. You see it in terms of equality and justice, human rights, war and peace issues. And you see rock and roll artists themselves being really involved in major education projects and also major nonprofit activities. So they're making a difference. And it was a real privilege. I interviewed about 60 different major artists, all the way down to people, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, all the way down to people at the local, you know, medium-sized market, that kind of thing.
So you identify the four values that you say rock and roll advanced around the world: freedom, equality, human rights, and peace. Mm-hmm. Can we walk through each maybe and talk about
sure.
sort of some examples of how they manifested themselves?
Sure.
So start with freedom.
Yeah. Other authors have done whole books on the impact of rock and roll in the Soviet Union, for example. But so I have a more narrow focus on that. But I interviewed Liberty DeVito, the drummer from Billy Joel's band, and they did the first big rock concerts in the Soviet Union in 1987. And so it was really fascinating, you know, to get his, you know, ground level take on what went into that, you know, at that period of time. And even a small thing, they put these big rock concerts on the Soviet Union, and fans weren't sure how to react, yeah. right? But eventually, by the end of that, they're running up to the stage and doing what young people would do at rock and roll concerts. And it really became sort of this embodiment of freedom. Now, I'm not arguing that rock and roll is causal in something like that. I mean, the Soviet Union collapsed because it was a bad society,
right.
you know, and the economy, Gorbachev, everything. But you also see it, for example, in Eastern Europe, too. The original group, The original idea of this thing called Charter 77, which was this human rights thing that came in the Czechoslovakia in the early 1970s, was about a rock band. It came about a human rights statement over a rock band that had been inspired by the Velvet Underground, but was put in prison, jail, I think. And so Vaclav Havel and other people, you know, sort of rallied around them. But one other quick anecdote on the Eastern Europe is I encourage people to check this out on YouTube. You can watch a Bruce Springsteen concert that he does in 1988, I believe, in East Berlin. About 300,000 people there, plus a million people watching live on TV without a delay or anything. So the Cold War is really coming to an end. And if you look less at Bruce Springsteen, but at the audience, at these young people, they've internalized this freedom. They know every single word to every single Bruce Springsteen song, and they're singing along, right? So that's powerful. That's a real powerful kind of dynamic.
And so it's not so much the lyrics necessarily, but it's the rock and roll experience.
A song does not have to be political to be powerful. Yeah. Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who is not an overtly political song, but right. It is offering a warning. You know, and it also a warning that got a new life after 9/11 when they played it in New York City. For the Concert for Heroes, Roger Daltrey's penultimate scream, and at the end of that, you know, gives it a whole new sense of power. I mean, we will not get fooled again. You know.
What about the fourth value that we really haven't hit on, which is peace?
Sure.
What was that reflected in?
Well, so the peace issue, you know, sort of came. Really came alive when I interviewed Country Joe McDonald from Country Joe and the Fish, who did Feeling Like I'm Fixing the Die Rag song. And he there's kind of a dichotomy about the war and peace issues. There's actually a sort of, to a degree, a weaponization of music. We've actually seen it in Guantanamo Bay, where loud music was used as part of the softening people up, you know, for interrogation. And I write about that in the book a bit. So that's not necessarily what we normally think about when we think about, like, stopping a war or something like that, right? But you also think, like, Kenny Loggins, Into the Danger Zone, you know, in the movie...
Top Gun.
Yeah. So that's also been used for patriotic things and whatnot. I interviewed a journalist who was covering the wars in Afghanistan, a guy named John Landay, a great war correspondent, who played music with people in basements in Sarajevo while the bombs were coming down, right? Wow. You know, so the music in Vietnam especially, you know, it really became part of the ethos of a generation. And I talked to current soldiers in Iraq and veterans, and they say, we really don't have that same thing, that kind of unity dynamic. But part of that is also because, as Country Joe McDonald said to me, anti-war music doesn't get radio play. You know, it doesn't sell records. It doesn't make money. You know, so at the end of the day, people tend to prefer the patriotic kind of Toby Keith sort of reaction to 9/11 as opposed to, say, the Dixie Chicks. But the Dixie Chicks and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young in 2006 went on a tour. Dixie Chicks got in trouble a little earlier because of their statements against the war. Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young went on tour in 2006, and they played these songs by Neil Young, like Let's Impeach the President for Lying and things like that. And when they got to Atlanta, about a third of the people walked out. And I asked both Graham Nash and David Crosby when I interviewed them, and they said, well, first of all, I'd love to say to them, you know, what did you think you were getting into if you went to a Crosby, Stills, and Nash concert? There was likely to be something political.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, Graham Nash says, but think about it. I mean, the facts were on our side now.
Right.
The people who walked out were wrong. The people who said, let's burn Dixie Chicks records or whatever, they were wrong.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we all have to think about and use the inspiration that we get from our artists to challenge ourselves. So that's one of the lessons that comes from that.
So I'd like to explore that a little bit more, but I want to finish the other values that we talked about, equality and human rights. I think about the Concert for Tibet in the 1970s, one of the first real major rock events that is driven at a cause. It doesn't end there, though.
Well, it starts with George Harrison in Bangladesh in the early 70s, and then by 1979 is a crucial year. You have the No Nukes concert, Rock for Kampuchea, and a couple years later, Graham Nash puts together this big Peace Day in Los Angeles, all of that culminating eventually in Live Aid.
Mm-hmm.
So the role of those concerts and whatnot was kind of twofold. One was to raise money, like Live Aid,
right.
But the Free Tibet concerts, I interviewed the woman who helped coordinate them with the Beastie Boys, and they really took those as more messaging. How can we mobilize pressure to put on politicians? And so when Live 8 comes around 10 years or 20 years after Live Aid, they mainly use that as a, not as a fundraising thing, but as a way to put pressure on the G8, I think it was, right, at the time, who was meeting in Scotland. They got millions of signatures and commitments from leaders to address the problems, of, especially of debt relief in Africa. So.
It is often said that music is the universal language. What is it about the rock genre specifically that is unique in what we're talking about here that connects to people around the world? Mm-hmm. You don't even have to, of course, know English or the language in which the rock was recorded to react to it.
Yeah, so I interviewed the singer of an underground group in Iran, which has had a very hard time being heard more than anything. They can record there, but it's hard to be heard. But when I talked to them, it was fascinating to hear him say that, you know, what they're really trying to do is express freedom. Yeah, and so that freedom is sort of, it's a broader philosophical concept, but that's what rock and roll in many ways unleashed. You know, there was a lot of pent-up, sexual things and whatnot, too, that came with it.
Elvis Presley, of course.
But as that evolved, too, into the 1960s with the Beatles and so on, this nexus between the Byrds and Bob Dylan and the Beatles. And it starts, with Bob Dylan doing these really powerful protest songs, but he evolves into more sort of existential things, songs like Desolation Row and Ballad of a Thin Man and whatnot, real contemplative reflections on society. But what's really interesting is when you hear these artists talk about, for example, I interviewed Kate Pearson from the B-52s, and she related a story about how, and most artists would say a similar story about how a young woman came up to her and said that, I was a loner, I didn't have friends, I was really depressed or down, and then I heard your record, and then I met other people that heard your record, and we had a bond together, and literally it saved my life. It's those connections. Another song that is introspective that everybody could relate to in a way is a great song like In My Room by Brian Wilson.
One of those great tunes.
Yeah, and it's not a political song, but it's a song about, like, what am I doing here? Who am I? Why am I here? And that raises a really sort of broader context. So rock and roll, but sometimes, like Joe McDonald says, well, part of it was just that we literally took it to 11. Like, it was loud.
So the values that you identified, freedom, equality, human rights, peace, you're an international relations scholar. We mentioned that. There's an alignment between these values and the values that American foreign policy has espoused. Maybe not lived up to, but espoused throughout, particularly the second half of the 20th century. Is that a coincidence?
Well, in international relations, we have an idea of soft power. And when you talk to, like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, for example, literally went to the Berlin Wall as it was falling down. They were in New York doing a big concert for the UN. And then the wall started coming down. So they got on a plane and they flew to Berlin. And they were literally there chopping down the wall with other people. But what both of them said was what really mattered when you saw the people on the other side of the wall was that they were just like us and that they wanted the things that we had, too. And music was a big part of that. They were literally in the Soviet Union gathering in parks and making little tapes off of transistor radios, and that was how they would pass it around in the underground thing. Now, there was literature, too, and poetry and plays and other things. It wasn't just music. But, I've got great quotes from Russians who say, when when they heard the Beatles, it was this total alternative worldview of just happiness, Or in Iran today, a few years ago, a number of young student-age, college-age people were actually arrested for putting a video out of the song Happy by Pharrell. But they weren't dressed appropriately, they thought. And so there is a backlash to these things, too. You know, this whole notion of like, shut up and sing. We don't want to hear your political commentary, as if you give up your citizenship rights when you become
an artist. By becoming a rock star. Yeah. We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. You can tweet me at JM Lutis. Alongside me from the Providence Journal, G. Wayne Miller. He's tweeting at G. Wayne Miller. This program is produced by a tremendous crew at Rhode Island PBS, and it's broadcast four times each week on SiriusXM's Politics of the United States, the POTUS channel, 124. Our guest this week is the author of a new book on the impact of rock and roll on American culture and politics. He's Sean Kay, and you can tweet him at SeanK_Rocket. Sean, how does this tradition of rock and roll mesh with, or how does it grow from the songs from the folk tradition? You mentioned, you know, Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Dylan. They come from a folk background.
Sure. So David Crosby was really helpful in walking me through this lineage, basically, when I interviewed him. And in effect, he takes it back to not just the folk artists, but the whole troubadour tradition of people in days long gone by that would come, artists often would come through towns and, as Crosby put it, you know, tell you everything's fine, it's midnight, go to sleep, or it's 11 o'clock and Congress just got bought by the Koch brothers or something like that. You know, so that they're telling stories, right? They're relating narratives. And you know, I interviewed also Serge Tankian from the band System of a Down. He talks about how, you know, a lot of music is just sort of ear candy. People want to feel good, and some of it's pop and dance stuff and whatnot, but some of it is message music, and it can be very, very powerful if it can cut through. It is a little harder now today. You're talking about the war music, like a song like Ohio by again CSNNY. That could really break through and be a transformational moment. It is harder to do that now, mainly because of the nature of the radio business and the recording business. You can get it, like again, he's a hip hop artist, not a classical rock artist, but the song "Same Love." You know, it talks about marriage equality, right? I mean, that's a powerful, trend-setting song, you know, by Macklemore, and it. You know, but it is a little harder to get that through because now radio, only about six major corporations own 90% of the radio stations in this country now. And so it's the playlists are data driven, top down. So it's very hard for these troubadours to get their messages out. At one level, because of technology and things like Spotify or YouTube, it's more lower D democratic. Anyone can make a record or put something up on YouTube. That's great. But to really make a major transformational breakthrough, today, the way Bruce Springsteen became famous, like going from New Jersey out into like Cleveland, Ohio, you know, they would have people that would go to local WMMS radio and play the record, and the DJ would make a decision whether they want to take a chance on this kid from New Jersey or not, right? That doesn't really happen anymore, except for, frankly, public radio, local public radio stations often, you know, carry those things.
Springsteen writes about that memorably in his recent memoir from Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, I bought it. I haven't read it yet.
You have to read it. It's a really wonderful memoir. Talk a bit about the roots of soul, or rock, mm-hmm. that also lie in soul, because it doesn't just come from folk in the troubadour tradition.
Sure. Sure,
there are deep roots in soul.
Yeah. I think one of my...
And blues and soul.
I was very lucky to interview George Clinton from Parliament Funkadelic, and in fact, saw him a few weeks ago as well. And he relates how he came to learn about Robert Johnson and blues after he listened to and heard Eric Clapton. You know, so it was listening to this Englishman that brought him back to his roots. All right. Whereas Billy Bragg, for example, who I also interviewed, an English artist, he ends up finding out about Bob Dylan and others by listening to The Clash. And that takes him eventually back to Woody Guthrie. And he, in fact, does a record of Woody Guthrie songs eventually, approved by the family. But that troubadour tradition, you know, does remain alive. It's still out there. And the thing that's really interesting is the artists that really feel passionately about these things, it's who they are. You know, they do it because it's who they are. They're not doing it to make money or be rich or be famous. I mean, they really do genuinely care about things. I mean, when you listen to Graham Nash talk about the environment or something like that. I mean, he really means it.
It's not a personality. This is what he really believes.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight on why did rock prove such an effective vehicle for reaching so many different audiences in so many different parts of the world?
Well, it wasn't. The international part. That's interesting. But I'll come back to that. But the first part. Obviously, the rock and roll becomes ascendant, after World War II, combined with mass communication, the large television, everything that people can see, get access to these things. So it's really happening at that moment. But it also really did take some key individuals to push it, and Bob Dylan, of course, being the essential one, I think, combined with the Beatles and others. But and then that international aspect, of course, is interesting because these American sounds, soul and others, are and integrated bands too, like coming out of Memphis. I write about that in the book. That new sound of like Little Richard, right? I mean, Sinead O'Connor, also who I interviewed, she says, those are really powerful words, a wop-bop-a-loo-lop. It's this African-American, she's right.
Yeah, she is right,
at
absolutely.
The time, this African-American man on TV in your living room saying, I'm here and I'm proud, right? And we're gonna sing about it. And that's powerful. That really opened up a whole new way of thinking for people just watching it even on their TV sets.
So. Jim and I are openly jealous of this project and what you did.
Insanely, I think is probably the accurate word.
Insanely, because we both love
Rock.
Well,
anyone could write their own rock and roll story, and you could do it with 60 different artists, too. So,
well, we're jealous of that, too. You get to talk to all these artists. How'd you get going on this? What sparked this?
For me, I played music myself since I was 11 or so. I
rock music?
Played guitar in groups.
Really?
Even opened for a couple well-known bands.
Which ones?
OAR, for example. More local group in Ohio called Acoustic Hookah. But
wow.
So it's purely a hobby for fun for me. But the bigger issue, I also grew up in Berkeley in the early 70s, late 60s. And then we moved to Cleveland when I was in the sixth grade, which was just enough to confuse me for the rest of my life. but we loved it there. But that, too, I guess, impressionistically left an imprint on me, growing up around those things. But more precisely, when I was doing a lot of work on, and I still do, on national security issues, like war and terrorism and very difficult things, I personally found that the music helped me get through that. I would play music all day long, while I was writing, And it dawned on me to reach out to a couple artists. And one or two of them talked to each other. And then I started actually getting phone calls from artists, from Bill Payne from Little Feet, wanting to talk about the war in Afghanistan. And I thought, okay, wow. Let's talk about it. I did a book on Ireland and the crash of its economy and the sort of the things that were renewing that country. And that's kind of how I saw this book, too. Here's a pathway for renewal, as we go forward, too. And when I did that book on Ireland, I interviewed Sinead O'Connor, and she also pushed me early on to do this book.
That's interesting. When you think about the music scene today, mm-hmm. are there artists who are more self-consciously carrying this torch today? I mean, I remember after the Paris terrorist attacks, I remember U2, Bono did an interview mm-hmm. and talked about they saw themselves as troubadours. Mm-hmm. Are there artists today, though, who are more self-consciously carrying this torch?
I don't know if they do it self-consciously. Like I said, it's or purposely in that sense. It really is who they are. I do focus on U2 in the book, but to really elaborate on the street level U2, like U2 of 1979 mm-hmm. versus today. An artist from Dublin, Ireland named Damien Dempsey, and I think he does carry on that kind of tradition in a real sense. And he says, it's harder and harder to find these artists, but they're out there, and they have something to say, and especially as we go through a period of upheaval politically in this country and even around the world, of course, it's going to be more and more important to listen to them as we go forward.
So, as a scholar and as a rock musician yourself, if you had to write a song for these times, what would be in that song? Maybe what would the title be? What would the themes be?
Yeah, that's a great question.
You don't have to actually sing it for us. but what would be the components of that song?
Well, one thing that rock and roll does is challenge authority, you know, challenges power. And by the way, there are many other artists that I didn't mention. Lady Gaga would be a really good example of that.
Oh, yeah.
And when she played at the Super Bowl, a lot of people were congratulating her on not being overtly political.
Right.
She started the whole thing with a Woody Guthrie song.
That's right.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, it's like one of the most political songs ever written. Right. So This Land Is Your Land would probably be, to my mind, sort of the penultimate rockin' song.
And you know, you'd go in that direction.
Well, I don't know if I do occasionally write songs, but it takes about 10 years, and it's like going to a dentist.
Come back in a decade.
We'll be here.
But a song that reminds Americans of who and what we are, and the things that have made us great, right? And the tragedy of it is that there's real evidence that this art has been central to what made America great around the world. People are looking at us and listening to our music and seeing the things that we've created and appreciating us for that. So that's really at the core. And to challenge the things that are not making us great. For example, ideas of cutting public television funding or cutting funding for the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, you know, alone money for climate change and things like that. So there's going to be plenty of material out there. The challenge will be for artists to get through and be heard, because it really is a corporate world in terms of radio. Neil Young can get a song from 1972 played on classic rock, but his new music, you will not hear it on mass radio. You know, and it could be the best stuff he's ever written, but people just won't hear it.
We've got about 30 seconds left here. When I think about my own personal evolution as a music fan, and I think about so many of the songs from the 80s that had sort of that Cold War tinge to them, 99 Luftballons, 99 Red Balloons in English, right?
Which was banned in the Soviet Union,
right?
Interestingly enough.
So I just listened to that yesterday, oddly enough. It still has power.
And a whole host of other songs. Hope the Russians Love Their Children Too. Mm-hmm. Billy Joel singing about Leningrad after his visit there in 87.
Sunday Bloody Sunday.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah,
of
course.
So did, in terms of pop's interaction with these sort of purpose-driven music, did that peak, did that reach its apex in the 80s?
It was a time when it really did burst out. You know, we walked through the series of events and whatnot then, but I'm not so sure I'd say it's different now. But again, mentioning Lady Gaga, you know, doing a song like Born This Way or Macklemore and Same Love. So it's there, you know, it's there. But people have to really also want to go find it, you know, and they have to make the effort, and they also have to support these artists. They have to buy their T-shirts when they go to concerts. They have to buy their CDs. They have to pay for music to support an ecosystem that's sustainable.
It's the bottom line. We're unfortunately out of time. We've got to leave it there. He's Sean Kay. The book is Rockin' the Free World. If you want to know more about Storying the Public Square, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, or you can check out pellcenter.org. I'm Jim Lutis. He's G. Wayne Miller. We'll see you next week.